What I have done is I have used the 21 Servants of Sovereign Joy, which is the book that we're going through. I went through years ago the Confessions of St. Augustine, which is a good introduction to him, probably one of the more accessible works. And then I read probably the best single biography on Augustine, which is this one right here, Augustine of Hippo. I also had a couple books on Audible, some of the great courses series. One was called Augustine, Philosopher and Saint, and the other is St. Augustine's Confessions. And so I'm pulling from all of those resources for what we're going to be talking about today. Now, a quick note, some people call him Augustine and some people Augustine. I prefer Augustine, just like the city in Florida. I feel like that's an acceptable way to pronounce his name. We are going to, more or less for the beginning of what we're going to talk about, we're going to follow the course of his life as it is described in the Confession. So I will be pulling a lot from this book. And the Confessions is a book that Augustine wrote when he was about 40 years old. It details what he had been going through in his life that brought him to that point and how he came to the point where he is now engaged in ministry. So this is a pastoral book, interestingly. It's written now that he is in ministry, and it gives a bit of a background about him. And as we will see, by no means is it trying to whitewash his past. Augustine will be very open and honest about his flaws, but he will also show the ways that God has worked in his life to change him. The Confessions is a very interesting book because although we would probably describe it as a biography, it is certainly not biography in the way that we normally think of it. To begin with, Confessions is written as a prayer. The entire thing is a prayer. And so it is a conversation between him and God that we get to listen into and to eavesdrop. You might notice as well, when you read the Confessions, another difference in how it is not biography. Most biographies, we focus on the external events that happen to a person. I lived in this place, I went to this place, I did this thing. The Confessions gives us precious few details about some of the things that we are very interested in knowing about Augustine. On the other hand, there are things that we would quickly pass over as rather insignificant that the Confessions will spend a great deal of time talking about. So you might better describe this as a biography of the inner man, the inside of a person, the moments in his life that really matter and shape him into the person that he is today.
Being written a day or two ago, how hard is it to read?
It's somewhat challenging. That's why I would recommend, if you're interested in it, maybe start with one of those books like the Audible course that I mentioned. I can pass it on to you afterwards as well, to get an introduction to it.
What year was it written?
Around 390 AD.
Oh, wow.
Yes. So, as we come across Augustine, and one of the ways in which he is so remarkable for us today is the fact that no other ancient thinker gives us such a unique glimpse inside of himself. The Apostle Paul probably comes the closest in his description of the old man and the new man, and especially in sections like Romans 7 where we see internal wrestling. But no other ancient author really talked like that. And so Augustine is the first one to give us a picture of the inner life of a human being in this dramatic and very vivid detail, as you'll see. So I want to begin by opening with the very same introduction that he gives us in the Confessions, and this is how he opens his book. He says, "Great are you, O Lord, and greatly to be praised. Great is your power, and of your wisdom there is no end. And man, being a part of your creation, desires to praise you. Man, who bears about with him his mortality, the witness of his sin, even the witness that you resist the proud. Yet man, this part of your creation, desires to praise you. And you move us to delight in praising you. For you have made us for yourself, and our hearts are restless until they rest in you." Now, Augustine is born on November 13th, 354, and You might remember from last week, we talked about Athanasius. So this is right in the middle of the time that Athanasius is in the middle of his fighting with Arius about the doctrine of the Trinity. But by the time that Augustine will enter ministry and become a Christian, that fight is basically in the past. The questions about the Trinity have been resolved within the church. He is born in a small village called Thagaste, which is near Hippo in northern Africa. And again, interestingly, Athanasius is from Egypt. Augustine is born in modern-day Algeria, so he is an African theologian of the church. Yet this Africa is part of the Roman Empire. It's ruled by the Romans. They consider themselves members of Roman society. His mother's name is Monica, and she's a Christian. She's a very significant person in his life. His father's name is Patricius, and we barely hear about him. He's a pagan for most of his life. Only at the very end does he become a Christian, and then he dies when Augustine is still a teenager. In the middle, this is in the middle of Athanasius' career that he's born. And when Augustine describes himself, he's going to go back in his confessions all the way to when he was still an infant. That's where he starts, by describing himself as an infant, based primarily on what he's observed other infants are like, and therefore what he assumes himself to have been like. And this is what he says of himself: "For before you, none is free from sin, not even the infant, which has lived but a day upon the earth. Then, in the weakness of the infant's limbs, and not in its will, lies its innocence. I myself have seen and known an infant to be jealous, though it could not speak. It became pale and cast bitter looks on its foster brother. Who is ignorant of this? Yet we look leniently on these things, not because they are not faults, nor because the faults are small, but because they will vanish as age increases." So he says, even as an infant, I wasn't a very good person. And people would say, oh, he's such a cute little baby. He's so innocent. But I was innocent because I was small, not because I was good. That's why they would call me innocent. So he's going back to the very beginning of who he is. And he relates some different incidences that happened throughout his early life. One of them that he spends a great deal of time on is this incident that happens when he's still a boy, maybe in early teenage years. One of those things that we might not pay much attention to in a biography, but it's a marked moment in his life. I want to tell you the story of this from his words. He says, "There was a pear tree close to our vineyard, heavily laden with fruit, which was tempting neither for its color nor its flavor." So it doesn't have good fruit on it. "To shake and rob of this, some of us wanton young fellows went late one night and carried away great loads, not to eat ourselves, but to fling to the very swine, having only eaten some of them." So he says, we went to this tree and we shook it and we took all the pears. It wasn't ours. We stole the pears, not because they were good, but just to feed them to some pigs. "And to do this pleased us all the more because it was not permitted. It was foul, and I loved it. I loved to perish. I loved my own error, not that for which I erred, but the error itself." This is significant here because he's looking at himself in the past, and he says, why did I do this deed? There was no benefit in it for me. There's nothing that I gained from it except one thing: the ability to break a rule that I didn't want to keep. That gave me pleasure. That was enjoyable to me. And I think that in this way, when he gets to studying Paul, and especially sections like Romans 7, where Paul talks about the law as diagnosing our sinful condition, showing us that the human heart wants to break laws, and that's an evidence of the sinfulness that we have within ourselves, he's going to be he's going to bring a unique perspective because he's had these incidences in his life where he sees his own sinfulness in these occurrences. Now, as Augustine grows older, specifically when he becomes 16, he comes across the sin that will become the great sin that he has to struggle with until he becomes a Christian, and even after he's a Christian. He says, "Where I was and how far was I exiled from the delights of your house in that 16th year of the age of my flesh, when the madness of lust held complete sway over me, and I resigned myself entirely to it. Those about me, meanwhile, took no care to save me from ruin by marriage, their sole care being that I should learn to make a powerful speech and become a persuasive orator." And he's going to struggle with lust as the great sin that he cannot free himself from. You'll also notice those around him are focused on one thing in particular. They want him to be a great orator, to be able to speak well, to be a great speaker. Today, we may not place as much emphasis on that, but in ancient Rome at this time, to be a great orator was one of the most secure paths to great power and prominence, because if you could speak well, you could influence people. And if you can influence people, you can influence senators, you can influence rich men, you can influence the emperor, and you can hold great political power and great sway. So Augustine realizes he has this problem, and it is a problem that is keeping him from God. It is keeping him from what's important in life, from pursuing the things that matter. But everyone around him is more interested on him making progress in climbing the ranks of society. So he moves to Carthage, and he says this: "To Carthage I came, where a cauldron of unholy loves bubbled up all around me. I loved not as yet, yet I loved to love. I searched about for something to love, in love with loving. For within me I had a dearth of that inward food, yourself, my God. To love and to be loved was sweet to me, and all the more when I succeeded in enjoying the person I loved." So Augustine, you can tell, although he grows up with his mother as a Christian, he's not really pursuing Christ in any way at this point in his life. He's pursuing the flesh and the desires of the flesh. But around this time, when he's about 18, 19 or so, he comes across a book written by the Roman author Cicero, who had lived several hundred years ago. Now, Cicero was a pagan. He was not a Christian. But he reads it. It's called the Hortensius. And the Hortensius, sadly, does not exist anymore. We've lost it to history. But he reads the Hortensius, and what it is Cicero urging people to study and pursue wisdom. And he reads this book, and it's a moment of transformation for him in his life. He goes from not caring about anything of that much value to reading the Hortensius, and suddenly he finds himself in love with wisdom. He wants to pursue wisdom. How does he find wisdom? And so it's the first great change in his life to make him look upward towards more lasting and permanent things. He says, "It altered my outlook on life. It changed my prayers to you, O Lord, and provided me with new hopes and aspirations. All my empty dreams suddenly lost their charm, and my heart began to throb with a bewildering passion for the wisdom of eternal truth. I began to climb out of the depths to which I had sunk in order to return to you." And so he says, "I want wisdom. How am I going to find it?" And his first thought is to turn to the Bible. He goes to the Bible. He reads the Bible, and he's very disappointed by it. He's an eloquent man himself. He's been learning how to write beautiful words and speak beautiful words, but the Bible doesn't have that. It has humble, plain words written to ordinary people, not written in the beautiful prose of Cicero and the ancient Roman orators. So he puts the Bible down as, "That was kind of a waste of time. I'm really disappointed. I thought there would be more substance to this." And maybe there is more substance, but he misses it because the style doesn't appeal to him. Now, at this point, Augustine is going to go through three types of belief that are going to progressively move him toward Christianity and toward himself being a Christian. But first, he goes through these three stages. And the first of the stages is something called Manichaeism. It's an ancient religion that was popular at that time. I wouldn't even necessarily say popular, but it was a religion. It was a minority religion in the Roman Empire at this time. And he sticks with Manichaeism for about 8 or 9 years, from about the age of 19 to 28 years old. During this time that he's a Manichae, he is also a teacher of rhetoric. And he's teaching students how to speak well. In some of the time is spent near Thagaste, which is close to Hippo, and some of that time is spent in the city of Carthage, which is the greatest city of Roman North Africa. But he hears about this group called the Manichaeists, and they are followers of an Eastern teacher named Mani. Mani was a Persian, and he claimed to be an apostle of Jesus Christ. Mani was a Gnostic teacher, and he holds to this belief system, and he teaches his disciples this belief system of a very strong dualistic tendency in nature. He says that there's a kingdom of light, and then there's darkness. And all of human history boils down to this conflict between the kingdom of light and darkness. Now, darkness is associated with all physical things. Everything that is physical or has substance to it is evil and is part of darkness. Instead, it is the kingdom of light, which is purely non-physical, which consists of things like the human mind, which you can't touch, you can't observe it, it's not available to the senses. This kingdom of light is in conflict with the kingdom of darkness. And so the Manichees said, by rejecting darkness, we can bring you towards the kingdom of light. And that's going to be very ascetic. You're going to have to discipline yourself because your body is evil. It's part of that darkness. You have to get rid of it. You have to get behind that. You have to be free from that so that you can focus on the kingdom of light. And so there's this constant dualism, this great fight going on in the world between the darkness and light. Augustine jumps into this, and the Manichees they had some very good speakers. They have that style to be able to persuade people. They also make claims. They say, we can prove our teaching. You don't have to so much take this on faith as you can test it. And they have some theories about how you can test it, which eventually he'll look back and he'll say they weren't very convincing. But at the moment, they seem very convincing to him. And so he jumps on board this Manichee philosophy. There was something about this, though, that was appealing. The fact that they are rejecting the flesh and the human body and just all of the physical world. Years later, a Manichee will write to him after he's left the Manichee religion. And he says, I knew that you always hated such stuff. I knew you were one who loved lofty things, things that shunned the earth, that sought out heaven, that mortified the body, that set the soul alive. And there's something appealing about this to him, a philosophy that teaches him to think this way, probably very much in line with what he was seeking after he read the Hortensians. Now, he's become a teacher of rhetoric. And as a teacher of rhetoric, he's very good at debating. So when he's in his hometown of Thagaste and when he's in Carthage, he starts to have arguments with the Christians around him, which we call the Catholic Christians, because at this point there's no Protestant Catholic. This is just what you call all Christians at this period, is Catholic Christians. And so as a Manichee, he's debating with Catholic Christians, and he's really good at it. He's always winning the debates because he can run circles around them. He's so good at defending the things that he has come to and using all of that education that he has. His mother, meanwhile, is absolutely distraught. Here is her son that has turned away from everything that he's been taught and gone into Manichaeism. And so she goes to a bishop and lays out the situation and asks for advice. What do I do with my son? And this is the advice that he gives her. He says, leave him alone. Just pray to God for him. From his own reading, he will discover his mistakes and the depth of his profanity. Leave me and go in peace. It cannot be that the son of these tears should be lost. And that's something that we notice about Monica. Through her entire life, she's always praying for him very earnestly. And he will credit that for his eventual conversion to Christianity, is what his mother does. He spends a lot of time in this belief system, but eventually he starts to see some of the issues with it. And they become more and more obvious to him. And when he goes and asks for help from the other Manichees to work through these intellectual problems that he has, they all say, wait till Faustus gets here. Faustus is the great teacher of Manichaeism. And he's going to be coming to North Africa soon. And when he gets here, he can answer all of your questions and really set you straight on this. So Augustine waits. And Faustus does arrive. And when he meets Faustus, he finds that Faustus is a very eloquent man, very skilled at rhetoric, just like himself, but not really any better in his substance than any of the other Manichees. He just knows how to make it sound better, but he doesn't answer the questions. And so around 28 years old, Augustine starts to move away from Manichaeism. He's disappointed by Faustus, and he starts searching around for some other belief system that can do a better job of explaining the world and reality. Now, there's some things that have been going on. during this time in his life. He's been teaching rhetoric, and while he's still a teenager, he takes a concubine, and he lives with her for about 15 years. So he's not married to her, but he's with her. In fact, he will even have a son, which he doesn't mention much in his book, but he has a son during this time. When he's 29 years old, he decides to take the voyage to Rome. He wants more students, and he wants higher caliber students, basically, is what it comes down to. So he travels to Rome to continue his teaching, which this is a good move for his career as well. And about a year later, he even goes from Rome to Milan. Now, we think of the Roman Empire as centered in Rome, and historically it was. But this is the late Roman Empire. By this time, the emperors need to be close to the frontier in northern Europe, where all the invasions are coming. So they've basically moved the capital from Rome to Milan. By moving to Milan, that tells us something about Augustine that he doesn't tell us himself, which is he's very good at his job. He gets hired to a very important post. He's right next to the emperor. He's clearly one of the best rhetoricians in the Roman Empire at this point. He's profoundly good at what he does, at saying things well. But as he's gradually coming to realize, it doesn't matter how well you say it, so much as if what you are saying is good, if there's a substance to what you're saying. So he goes to Milan, and while he's at Milan, he hears about this preacher. The man's name is Ambrose. Ambrose is the bishop of Milan, obviously a very important place. He's the bishop of the city that the emperor is in. So he's one of the most skilled preachers in the world at this point. And Augustine isn't really interested in the Christian message. But he's heard that Ambrose is really good at speaking. So he says, well, that's my trade, is speaking. I should go and listen to Ambrose just to learn how he says his stuff so well. He starts to go to the sermons of Ambrose. And over time, he's only interested in the style. But Ambrose weaves that substance in. And he does it so well that Augustine can't avoid hearing what he's saying and really starting to ponder it and think about it. So gradually, Ambrose starts to lead him towards Christianity, but there's still a lot of stumbling blocks that he has. His mother, Monica, meanwhile, joins him in Milan. She travels there. And at this point in the Confessions, he gives us a story that I think is very significant, even though it's not particularly relevant to Augustine. I want to take a brief tangent now to talk about a story that Augustine includes about a friend of his, because he's always mentioning friends that he has. He was a man who certainly lived in community. But he talks about a friend named Alypius. Now, we've said that Augustine has this problem with lust. Lust is the great sin in Augustine's life. But he has a friend named Alypius, and Alypius just doesn't get his struggle with lust. It's like, it's not that big of a deal. How do you have such a problem with this lust thing? But Alypius has another problem, a different problem. Alypius's problem is violence, specifically watching violence at the gladiatorial games. They still have amphitheaters. They still put men in there to fight to the death. And that is the thing that Alypius is absolutely addicted to. And I think it's interesting. It gives us a picture into how Augustine thinks about these things to see how Alypius developed this problem. I'm going to quote from Confessions as he describes this. He says of his friend Alypius, "He had gone before me to Rome to study law, and there he was carried away in an extraordinary manner with an incredible eagerness after the gladiatorial shows. For, being utterly opposed to and detesting such spectacles," so notice, he doesn't come like that. He comes hating that. He's not interested in that. "He was one day met by chance by various of his acquaintances and fellow students returning from dinner, and they, with a friendly violence, drew him, vehemently objecting and resisting, into the amphitheater on a day of these cruel and deadly shows." So you get the picture. They come, they see him on the street, and they're like, "Hey, we're going to the gladiatorial games, come join us." He's like, "No, absolutely not. No, 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 I don't do that. That's not my thing." And they're like, "Ah, come on, come on." And they finally persuade him to come. But this is what he says as they bring him. He says, though you drag my body to that place and there place me, can you force me to give my mind and lend my eyes to these shows? Thus shall I be absent while present and shall overcome both you and them. I'm not going to enjoy it. I don't want to be there. I'll be there just because you want me to, but that's the only reason. But he, and then it describes, okay, they all come in, they sit down in the amphitheater, but he, shutting up the doors of his eyes, forbade his mind to roam abroad after such naughtiness. So he's sitting there in the amphitheater with his eyes shut. I'm not thinking about it. This is not what I want to do. Upon the fall of one in the fight, a gladiator falls, a mighty cry from the whole audience stirring him strongly. He, overcome by curiosity and prepared, as it were, to despise and rise superior to it, no matter what it were, opened his eyes and was struck with a deeper wound in his soul than the other, that is the gladiator, whom he desired to see was in his body. And he fell more miserably than he on whose fall that mighty clamor was raised. It's a fascinating picture that he's giving us. Here, the gladiator falls, but Alypius, he's so overcome with curiosity, just one look to see what's happening. He opens his eyes, and that is the moment that he in his spirit falls. Now, we learn so much about the way that Augustine thinks at this moment. Because, and this I think very much parallels maybe the way that you would read C.S. Lewis in the Screwtape Letters. You have the external world, but then you have the internal world of souls that last forever. Which is the greater event? The fact that a man died just then in the amphitheater? Or the fact that he opens his eyes and his soul, something happens in his soul falls. He says, was struck with a deeper wound in his soul than the other. That man was struck with a fatal wound, but here's a man whose soul was struck with an even more fatal wound. Because as he looks, directly he saw that blood, he therewith imbibed a sort of savageness. Nor did he turn away, but fixed his eye, drinking in madness unconsciously, and was delighted with the guilty contest. And from this moment, from that one look, Alypius becomes absolutely addicted to going to the gladiatorial shows and watching this violence all the time, any chance that he can get. Again, I think it's a very C.S. Lewis sort of way of looking at the human soul as the more important than the body, the part of you that lasts forever. I think it's also very interesting in that it shows some things that Augustine must have thought about afterwards as he thought about things like the freedom of the will. How free are we to choose right and wrong? Here's an individual who is absolutely convinced that he's not going to give in to this. And yet, unconsciously, as it were, on his part, he falls and he becomes absolutely addicted to this thing that he was so opposed to prior. Now, that's all a tangent. I think it's helpful as we think about how Augustine thinks about things. But let's get back to the story. At this point, Monica, his mother, does want him to be married. He's clearly progressed in his career. It's time for him to find not just someone, but really a wife who is suitable rank for him. And so he says that because of this, as they're starting to arrange a marriage for him with some very rich Roman girl, he has to get rid of the concubine that he's had for 15 years. He says, the woman with whom I had been living was torn from my side as an obstacle to my marriage. And this was a blow which crushed my heart to bleeding because I loved her dearly. She went back to Africa, vowing never to give herself to any other man. But I was too unhappy and too weak to imitate this example set me by a woman. And here's the thing. He's not going to marry this woman quite yet. He's still got a couple years. And so he says, I took another mistress without the sanction of wedlock because he just can't get over his problem of lust. And so even though he sent his one concubine away, he can't do it. He's got to have another one. And he takes the mistress. But in 386, he comes across the writings of Plotinus, a Neoplatonist. Platonism is a very fascinating topic. And if we think of it, we don't have time really to go into it very well, but Plato gives some very interesting ideas to the Greek-speaking world. It's difficult to summarize the Neoplatonist viewpoint, but Plato held that there was a distinct difference between the physical world and the world of the eternal forms that exist out there. external existences which are not based on matter, but which are played out in man, in matter. Now, Neoplatonism takes this further. Basically, in Neoplatonist philosophy, at the center of existence is the one, the monad, the single point of existence. And all things flow out of this single point of existence. You can think of it kind of like the sun and all the light just streaming out of the sun. Now, the farther you go from the one, the less good that existence is. Just like the light that comes from the sun. You get really close to the sun, it's really bright. You get farther and farther, it gets less and less and less. But Neoplatonism doesn't say that it's bad, it's just less. So the physical world is a manifestation of the one, but it's kind of far removed from the one. So it's not bad, it's not evil, it's just not as good as what is closer to the one. Things like mind and spirit are closer to the one, therefore they are better. But we're not really talking about evil, we're just talking about good versus better. And again, I hope that that's a good enough summary because we don't really have time to talk more about it. But the goal of existence in the Neoplatonist philosophy is to turn towards the one, to look away from the physical world, the world of the senses, to go back towards the one and to move in that direction intellectually, spiritually, to move towards this source of all existence. And so this becomes the second philosophy that Augustine will adopt. First the Manichees, then this Neoplatonism. But then Neoplatonism actually is interesting because it's not so much a hindrance for him in his journey towards Christianity as it is simply a stepping stone towards Christianity. Neoplatonism actually was helpful for him in some interesting ways. Augustine had always struggled very much with this concept of the omnipresence of God. God is everywhere. Okay, but what does that mean? Like, I'm not everywhere. Imagine if I had a gigantic body that could fill the entire universe. Is that what God is like? And that doesn't seem to make much sense. He couldn't get in his mind how God could be everywhere and yet not have a physical presence. The Neoplatonists help him to come to a conception or understanding of God as a being who can be everywhere and yet not be physical. And so they help him bridge this gap towards Christianity. They also give him this understanding of turning towards the one that helps him to understand sort of some Christian ideas about turning towards God that he had always been a little bit unclear on. And they helped him to understand the physical world as not being evil. It's not as good, perhaps, as God. It's not as good, perhaps, as mind or spirit, but it's not evil in itself. And so, in this way, Neoplatonism moves him towards an understanding of Christianity. During all of this time, he continues to go to church and listen to Ambrose preaching. And at a certain point, he gets there intellectually. He gets to the point where he says, God, Christianity, the Bible, it's true, and I actually accept this. This is what he says of it himself. But having then read those books of the Platonists and being admonished by them to search for incorporeal truth, I saw your invisible things understood by those things that are made. Of these things was I indeed assured, yet too weak to enjoy you. It's an interesting way that he puts it there. I was indeed assured. So he's convinced now of Christian truth, yet too weak to enjoy you. He's there mentally, intellectually, but something's lacking still. It's not enough that he's there intellectually. Something more needs to come. And the problem, as Augustine will be honest, is that his lust is still the thing that is holding him back from completely being a Christian. This is what he says, "The enemy had control of my will, and from that had made a chain to bind me fast. From a perverted act of will, desire had grown. And when desire is given satisfaction, habit is forced. And when habit passes unresisted, a compulsive urge sets in. By these close-knit links I was held." So he describes his sin as a chain that is binding him. Very interesting picture, because that is a picture that was used by the Platonists themselves, but more significantly, that's also a picture that Paul uses to describe our sin as bondage, as slavery. And so he's seeing it in the Platonist understanding, but he's also picking it up now from Christianity. By this point, Augustine has returned to the Bible. Originally, he'd set it aside. It was not lofty or grand enough. But now he's starting to see that maybe that negative was actually a positive. It speaks to humble men who need humility in order to approach the Word of God. And so Augustine begins studying Paul in great detail. And at this point, he talks about a friend who came to visit. This friend comes, and they're sitting around kind of having story time. And the friend says, "Let me tell you about some guys I knew. They were out walking one day, and while they were walking, they came to this place, and there was a book there. And these friends, they started to read this book. It was The Life of St. Anthony." Now, if you were here last week, we talked about The Life of St. Anthony. And you remember who wrote that book. Athanasius writes The Life of St. Anthony. Anyways, these friends, they're reading The Life of St. Anthony. And The Life of St. Anthony is so profound for them that they give up their secular life to go live as monks and to renounce the world and to give away all that they have and to follow his example. And so this friend relates this story to Augustine. And Augustine is very troubled by the story. It really speaks to him because he knows his problem. He's not there. He's not given up everything to follow Christ. There's still this one great sin in his life that he cannot get past. But he wants to get past it, but he can't get past it. But he wants to get past it. And he's wrestling with this. He's really struggling with this. At one point in his past, actually many times in his past, he had prayed this prayer. "Lord, give me chastity and continence, but not yet." He wants it, but not yet. It's too enjoyable in the moment. And so his friend Alypius is actually there with him. And he says to his friend Alypius after they hear this story, "What is wrong with us? The unlearned start up and seize heaven. And we, with our learning, see where we wallow. We know so much, but we've not done what so many others have done, which is renounce the flesh and the world in order to follow Christ." So at this point, he's very distraught. He goes into this garden, and he's in mental torment. He describes this as pulling at his hair, striking his forehead, squeezing his knees, like sitting there kind of curled up in a ball. And he's in real spiritual distress. He recognizes that to truly repent will be turning away from his lust. And in this moment, all of those images of his mistresses come back to mind. And they're talking to him. And they say, "Do you part with us? And from that moment, shall we no more be with you forever?" He knows that he wants Christ, but he cannot will himself to want Christ. He knows that he wants to want Christ, but he can't will himself to actually make that decision. So he's in turmoil. He says, "And as I spoke, I all but came to a resolve. I all but did it. Yet I did it not, hesitating to die unto death and to live unto life." He's so close. He's almost there, but he can't bring himself to make that decision on his own. "I was saying these things and weeping in the most bitter contrition of my heart, when lo, I heard the voice as of a boy or girl, I know not which, coming from a neighboring house, chanting and oft repeating, 'Take up and read, take up and read.' So quickly I returned to the place where Alypius was sitting, for there I had put down the volume of the Apostles when I rose thence. I grasped, opened, and fell in silence, reading the paragraph on which my eyes first fell. Not in rioting and drunkenness, not in chambering and wantonness, not in strife and envying, but put on the Lord Jesus Christ, and make no provision for the flesh to fulfill the lusts thereof. No further would I read, nor did I need. For instantly, as the sentence ended, all the gloom of doubt vanished away." And it's that moment where his will, not just his intellect, but his will is transformed. He goes to his mother and he tells her about this, and she was overjoyed. And when we went on to describe how it had all happened, she was jubilant with triumph and glorified you who are powerful enough and more than powerful enough to carry out your purpose beyond all our hopes and dreams, for she saw that you had granted her far more than she used to ask in her tearful prayers and plaintive lamentations. Now, Augustine is baptized by Ambrose on Easter of 387 AD. And at this point, he retires from the rhetoric business. He developed a problem with his lungs that made it difficult, at least temporarily, for him to be able to speak as much as he had been. And so he retires. And him and his friends had a wealthy patron who donates this country villa to them. So they say, this is a great opportunity for us. We've renounced the world. We can go all live together on this country villa and spend our time thinking about God. And it's a beautiful idea in theory, but it doesn't last very long. Eventually they're like, let's go back to Africa and do something similar there. Let's kind of create a monastic community in Africa where we can do this together. So they travel back towards Africa. There's a bit of a delay on the coast while they're waiting for the ship. And while they're there, Monica, who's with them, actually passes away there in Ostium, which is a port near Rome. And so the Confessions kind of comes close to ending on that note with the death of Monica, but also the beautiful fellowship that him and his mother get to enjoy, focused on and centered on spiritual things in their last days together. So he returns from Africa, and that's basically where the Confessions leaves off. That's basically what has happened in his life when he writes that. So from this point, we're going to have to continue on without the aid of the Confessions. When he comes to Thagaste, he starts to form a monastic community, and he doesn't want to be involved in leadership in the church. That is not what he is going for. In fact, he's very careful. He will not even travel to a town that does not have a bishop, because he's so afraid that people might want him to be the bishop. But as he says it in later years, when he went one day to Hippo, which had a bishop, a slave may not contradict his lord. I came to this city to see a friend whom I thought I might gain for God, that he might live with us in the monastery. I felt secure, for the place already had a bishop. I was grabbed. I was made a priest. And from there, I became your bishop. In fact, he comes on the very day when the bishop happens to be preaching a message about the importance of educated young men entering the ministry. And Augustine is kind of well known by this point. The whole congregation turns and looks at this new visitor. And they say, we've got our man. And so he becomes a priest here, kind of like a deacon. And then from there, eventually becomes the bishop of the city of Hippo. And he'll live in Hippo for more than 40 years. In ministry there. Now, there are four fights that Augustine will have in the second half of his life while he is the Bishop of Hippo. And we're going to try to briefly run through these. The first one I'm not going to talk much about, but it is the fight against Manichaeism. Again, we don't have to talk much about this. You're familiar now with who the Manichaeans are, but he's very good now at debating the Manichaeans from the other side. Now, he is the Catholic bishop, and he is doing a really good job of destroying the arguments of the Manichaeans. So that's the first one that occupies several years of his life, is speaking against and writing against the Manichaeans. But the second one is the argument against Donatism. And with this, I think it's good to remember the subtitle of the book that we're going through, which is 21 Servants of Sovereign Joy, and the subtitle is, help me out with this, Colton and Terry, I think it's like faithful, flawed, and fruitful. And here's where we're going to see, okay, we've seen faithful, we'll see fruitful, but we're also going to see flawed, because there are some things here that we very much do not like about Augustine. The Donatist controversy began in 311, so this is about 40 years before Augustine is born. And in 311, the church was still under persecution. Now, right now, it's not. The Roman Empire is officially Christianized. But in 311, it was officially pagan. And to be a Christian was a dangerous thing. One of the things that would happen is the Roman authorities would burst into the church. And they'd say to the bishop, give us your holy books so that we can destroy them. And there were two responses to that. You either didn't give it in and you risked all the consequences of not obeying the authorities, or you gave up the books to be destroyed. After the persecution subsides, a lot of people who have left the church because of persecution, they come back. They say, I was wrong. I recognize I was wrong. I shouldn't have recanted. I shouldn't have given in the books, but I did. And I'm back to repent and to rejoin the church. So what do you do with these people? Well, one group said, you welcome them back in. And they may even become bishops again of their congregations. The other group said, they've committed basically like the sin that you can't forgive, or maybe if you do welcome them in, you certainly never put them back in a leadership position. The Donatists were of that second group. But most of the churches were willing to reinstall them in the church and even sometimes in that office of bishop or priest in leadership roles within the church. And this becomes a huge division, especially in Africa. The Donatist problem really is specific to Africa because in 311, the bishop of Carthage elects the next bishop of Carthage. Caecilian is his name. Now, Caecilian never handed over the books. But the bishop who elects Caecilian did hand over the books at one point and had left the church and now comes back to the church. So the Donatists say Caecilian cannot be the next bishop because he's appointed by a man who doesn't have the authority to be the bishop. Okay? So, and this causes a huge split. Half of the churches basically say, yes, he can, because he is lawfully put into this role. The other half say, no, he's not, because the succession of authority basically stops there when he's elected. Anyways, it's a big controversy. One of the things, though, that this really gets down to that's very significant is whether the sacraments performed by that individual are valid or not. So let's say that you get baptized. Now, if within the larger church, they would say, were you baptized by a bishop? Were you baptized by a person in the church with the authority to baptize you? Yes, great. Your baptism is valid. But the Donatists would say, was he one who handed over the books? Well, yeah, he did hand over the books. Then your baptism isn't valid. You have to be rebaptized. So this causes a lot of controversy within the church, specific to North Africa. And more importantly, there's this difference in the way that the two groups understand the church. Significantly, they both agree on theology. They have no difference in their theology, but they disagree on this question of authority and, broader, how do you think about the church? The Donatists think of the church as preserving something and needing to be very careful to maintain that set of distinctives against the world. They still think of themselves as the Church of the Martyrs, even though no one's being martyred by this point. And there's a lot about this viewpoint that I do appreciate. I think that there is something of significance and something worthwhile to this understanding of the church as preserving and as not just kind of giving into culture in a broad way. But we have something unique and specific, and I think that's a very biblical idea to have this. But there are some contradictions. The Donatists were not a Puritan group in the way that you might think about that from what I've just described. There's a very real sense in which they're very closed off. They're very anti-culture. Maybe you could think about this. Maybe a parallel might be some independent fundamental Baptist churches. Like, they've got that very secluded culture to them. The Donatist church has that very much. They also say to all the Christians throughout the entire rest of the Roman Empire, none of you are genuine Christians. We are the only church that is out there and that is genuine, because we held to this when all of you turned away from it. As one author says, the Donatist church was pure in an obvious and not particularly exacting sense. It had kept itself pure from a single unspeakable crime, from traditio, the sacrificing of the Christian law. That is, from a crime committed by total strangers in a conveniently distant past. So there's nothing so much that's really unique about them in the present time, except the fact that way back before anyone in the present generation is around, they hadn't done the bad thing. As I read about it, there's a lot that I appreciate about this Donatist viewpoint, but also a lot that I was not so thrilled with, and I wasn't super sympathetic to all of it. On the other hand, you have the Catholic perspective, which is, this is the moment when Christianity is now legal, and they are eager to accept into the church all whom they can welcome in with the chance of giving them the truth about Christ. And Augustine in particular formulates this idea of the church as a hospital for the sick. He says there are many, and he's very honest about this, he says there's many people in the church who are not genuine Christians, but there is a core of the church that is the elect. And we want all the people we can in the church, because the elect will, through the church, find the truth about Christ. I think there's some really neat things about Augustine's viewpoint, particularly this idea of the church as a hospital for the sick. I think that's a really neat way of looking at it. But I also don't agree with Augustine in this idea of opening the church door so broadly that we don't preserve this something very unique. I think that that is something of a rejection of the way that the early church was in the first century. Augustine frankly said, "The man who enters is bound to see drunkards, misers, tricksters, gamblers, adulterers, fornicators, people wearing amulets, assiduous clients of sorcerers, astrologers. He must be warned that the same crowds that press into the church on Christian festivals also fill the theaters on pagan holidays." So he's very open about this, that that's the church, and it's going to be filled with all kinds of bad people, but it's a hospital for bad people to help move them towards health. And in the end, quite regrettably, and this is really probably the single thing that is the most concerning about Augustine, is that he will be one of those who will encourage and even argue for the persecution of the Donatist church by the Roman authorities. Now, there are a few things that we can clarify. This was not a persecution to death. He never advocated the death penalty, nor was that given to the Donatists. But he very much supported that the government would go in, they would close down the Donatist church, they would disband the congregation, and eventually they would even demand the Donatists to join the Catholic congregations or pay a fine. Augustine himself was against the death penalty for heretics. He never wanted that. He always thought that that was the wrong way to view it. But he does support this persecution. How does he do that? How does he justify it? Certainly, he didn't think that you could force someone to believe. He's far too deep of a thinker to think that that would work. He understands that there's the will, and you have to gradually move the will. You can't coerce someone to believe. But his argument was, let's make it difficult for people to become Donatists, because if it's difficult, less people will do it. And they'll just naturally go to the Catholic Church because it's easier. And if it's easier, they might hear the truth. And in that way, we can instruct them and gradually bring them towards the truth. So this is the argument that he will formulate, regrettably, and ultimately to great detriment throughout the Middle Ages, because that thinking will be amplified and taken to far greater extremes than Augustine would have ever approved of. But that is his controversy with Donatism, and it shows us one of many ways that we are not going to be in agreement with Augustine in his understanding of the church, in much of that, in his understanding of baptism and the sacraments, things that in many ways he's much closer to a Roman Catholic today than to a Protestant. A third belief system that he's going to argue against is paganism. There are still pagans. Even though it's a Christian empire, there are still pagans. And in 410, Rome itself is sacked. For the first time in 800 years, barbarian invaders go in and destroy the city. This was a monumental catastrophe for the world of this time. It hadn't happened in anyone's memory for so long. It was the fall of the greatest civilization in history, as the Romans understand it. And the pagans took this opportunity to say, the problem with Rome is the Christians. Before there were Christians, we worshiped the gods protected us, and we valued bravery and manhood and strength, good, solid virtues. And then the Christians came in, and look what we value now. Humility, meekness, gentleness. That's not the way that you hold together an empire. It's the Christians' fault. And so Augustine writes his greatest work called The City of God, and it is massive. 13 years and 22 books later, he finishes it. And the English translation is 1,184 pages long. But in short, his argument is that there are two cities, two communities. The earthly city, which is based on a love of self, and the city of God, which is based on love of God. And while we are on earth, we are sojourning in the earthly city. But we are meant to press on to attain the heavenly city, the city of God. The problem with the Romans, as Augustine says, is that they were therefore grasping for praise, open-handed with their money, honest in the pursuit of wealth, and they wanted to hoard glory. This is what they loved so wholeheartedly. For this they lived. For this they did not hesitate to die. All other lusts they battened down with this overwhelming desire. And he says that's the problem. They did have those manly virtues, as they would call them. But the problem is that's not good virtues to have at the center of a community. That's not what you should bring people together around. And now we're going to come to the last one, and we'll we're nearly to the end here. This is the great final controversy of Augustine's life. There's a man named Pelagius. He was a monk from Britain, but he travels to Rome, and while he's there, he comes across Augustine's works, and he really disagrees with Augustine's view of original sin. We've already seen how Augustine described himself even as a child, as a baby. But Pelagius says, this is ludicrous. If we are so radically in need of grace, then we are in the ludicrous position of God commanding us to do the impossible. God tells us to do things in the Word, and he knows we can't do them. That's ridiculous. Why would he tell us to do things that he knows we can't do? There was, in particular, a line in the Confessions that Pelagius was violently opposed to. Augustine had this prayer. He said, command what you will, give what you command. So, God, command whatever you want me to do, but give me the ability, the grace, to be able to accomplish it. Because you can command it, but I can't do it myself. You have to give me not just the command, but also the grace to do the command. And Pelagius very much disagrees with that. We can summarize the Pelagian view in 6 propositions. Adam's sin harmed only himself, not the human race. Human beings are born in the same moral state as Adam before the fall. So just like Adam, we have complete ability to choose right or wrong. Death is a natural necessity, not a punishment for sin. So you will die whether or not you sin. Grace is not necessary for doing good. Human free will suffices. You don't have to have grace. You have the ability to choose to do good or wrong. God's grace is given according to human merit. So it's a reward if you do good, not something that helps you to do good in the first place. And finally, a sinless life is possible without special divine grace. Theoretically, you could be perfect without God. Pelagius didn't necessarily say all these things himself, but these were the implications of the things that he was saying. And so, for Pelagius, the Christian life is a simple thing. Choose to do right. Discipline yourself to make the right decisions. But Augustine has a far deeper understanding of human existence and of the will. He says, even if I do not consent to it, there is still in me both something dead and something alive. Surely you cannot deny that this dead part of you belongs to you. One of the Pelagians said, it is the easiest thing in the world to change our will by an act of will. But as his biographer put it, Augustine had been certain for some 20 years that they could not of themselves choose to love. Some men try hard to discover in our will what good is particularly due to ourselves that owes nothing to God. How they can find this out, I just do not know. Augustine argued that we cannot desire what we do not love, what we are not drawn toward. But we will not be drawn toward God unless he grants us that love, that revelation of himself as something worth desiring. But this was not something that he could argue through pure logic alone. It was something that we must come to know and feel through our own experience, as he himself had come to realize in that moment in the garden years ago with Paul's book. Give me, says he, a man in love. He knows what I mean. Give me one who yearns. Give me one who is hungry. Give me one far away in this desert who is thirsty and sighs for the spring of the eternal country. Give me that sort of man. He knows what I mean. But if I speak to cold men, he just does not know what I am talking about. It is not that Augustine had come to this view lightly. He says himself, in answering this question, I have tried hard to maintain the free choice of the human will, but the grace of God prevailed. And when his friend asked why he spent so much time fighting this theological war with Pelagius, which takes him all the way to the end of his life, this is the way he answered. First and foremost, because no subject but grace gives me greater pleasure. For what ought to be more attractive to us sick men than grace, grace by which we are healed? For us lazy men, than grace by which we are stirred up? For us men longing to act, than grace by which we are helped? And he loves this subject of grace. It is his great emphasis. And while there are many things about Augustine that are very Roman Catholic, if you were to compare them to the present time, it is this emphasis on grace that the reformers more than 1,000 years later will pick up, and they will say, Augustine is ours because of this incredible emphasis on the grace of God, that he must take the initiative to work in our hearts, to give us this vision of his loveliness, before we can ourselves have any hope of being drawn to him. In 426, Augustine retired from some of his duties as bishop. I'm going to wrap this up real quick. He was already an old man, and his successor takes over. And by this time, the Roman Empire is on the verge of collapse. As he is on his deathbed, the king of the Vandals, Genseric, approaches Hippo with an army of 80,000 Vandal warriors from the Germanic north. The provinces of Africa did not so much resist as simply collapse in the presence of this barbarian invasion. And as he lay on his deathbed, the city of Hippo was put under siege. For some time, Augustine had been longing for a distant place, probably ever since he read the Hortensius. And he, at the end of his Confessions, he put it this way: "Let me leave them outside, breathing into the dust and filling their eyes with earth. And let me enter into my chamber and sing my songs of love to you, groaning with inexpressible groaning in my distant wandering, and remember Jerusalem with my heart stretching upwards in longing for it. Jerusalem, my fatherland. Jerusalem, who is my mother." And so on August 28th, 430, Augustine died. His biographer tells of his last days. He had ordered the four Psalms of David that deal with penance to be copied out. From his sickbed, he could see these sheets of paper every day hanging on his walls and would read them, crying constantly and deeply. And lest his attention be distracted from this in any way, almost 10 days before his death, he asked us that none should come in to see him except at those hours when the doctors would come to examine or his meals were brought. This was duly observed, and so he had all that stretch of time to pray. Now, we're out of time. There's so many lessons that we could draw from this. I think you can probably draw a lot yourself just thinking about this very remarkable life. One single thing that has really stood out to me that I think is a beautiful takeaway from Augustine's life is life lived as prayer. The fact that the Confessions is written as a book that is entirely a prayer. The fact that you see him at the very end of his life so deeply committed to prayer. I think that's a beautiful ideal for us as Christians to pursue. Let's pray. Our Lord, as we think about these deep subjects of your grace and our need for grace in every aspect of life, we recognize ourselves. We are unworthy of anything. We are unworthy of grace. Lord, spark within us holy desires. May we, as we come to your word, even this morning, be drawn to your loveliness, that we would love you, that we would desire you, delight in you, and will to pursue you by your grace. In Jesus' name, amen.